Hello and welcome to Wooden Spoons on CKUW 95.9 FM. My name is John Dick, and I'm here with community nutritionist Mary Jane Easton to discuss topics of healthy living, environmental issues, what's going on in our community, as well as other interesting things in this one-hour show. On Wooden Spoons, we recognize that all things are related, and with learning and awareness, we connect the dots that make up our world. Every Friday morning on Wooden Spoons, we speak with guests on today's relevant issues, share nutritious recipes, and explore important topics with perspectives not found in the mainstream media. Time right now is 8:02 a.m., and temperature outside is minus 16. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Good morning, John. It's not a bad day today.
No, outside wasn't too cold out.
Yeah, there's a bit of a wind, but at least it's not that cold. It's nice to see the bit of a touch of spring in the air.
Oh, for sure. But I mean, we both know that spring probably usually takes a while to come, actually. Still waiting on our guest. I did just send him the link, but he hasn't joined us yet, so...
Okay, well, I will just go through what we will be planning on this morning. And I don't know if I have our guest. I have his phone number as well. So I'm not sure if that's an option. But for this morning, the program this morning is we have a guest that usually comes at the first of the month, who I'll introduce shortly. His name is Harold Schuster, and we will be having some information on health, protecting our emotional health, and creating an emotionally healthy environment. And information on a healthy diet and avoiding refined foods. We have some announcements to make. And so we will just proceed from there. I will introduce our guest. This morning we are going to be joined by Harold Schuster. He's a member of Independent Jewish Voices, a grassroots organization in Canada grounded in Jewish tradition that opposes all forms of racism and advocates for justice and peace for all in Israel and Palestine. Harold has been joining us on a monthly basis, providing updates and information about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the purpose of promoting understanding and peaceful solutions. Today we will be focusing on the ceasefire agreement being imposed by the new president, Donald Trump, barely in office for 2 weeks, as well as his plans for the Palestinians and their home in Gaza. There are a lot of questions that need to be asked about our own relationship with the new president and how we should respond. And I think Harold has joined us just now.
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome to Wooden Spoons, Harold. I just introduced you.
Right.
How are you this morning?
Thank you. I apologize. I was so busy sort of doing my homework and getting ready that I forgot to check for the link. And when I went to look for it this morning, I couldn't find it. So my apologies to you and John.
Well, how did you find us then?
I sent you an email, and I thought, well, Mary Jane sometimes has trouble with email, so I sent a quick one to John asking him to resend me the link, and he was able to do that quite quickly, so thank you both.
Yes, well, I have been having some computer issues, and my computer at home, all my emails disappeared, so I can't do anything at home, which is a real pain. So, anyway... So I just introduced you, Harold, and I think maybe I'm not sure if the questions I presented were what you were wanting to be asked, and I feel quite free to change the focus.
No, that's fine. I've gone through them. I've tried to put down some notes and gather my thoughts around them. So I'm good to go with what you sent, and we'll see how many of them we can get through.
Okay. Okay, well, one of the first things that that astounds me is the autocratic attitude of President Trump, which abandons any sense of respect towards other nations, including the northern border of Canada. And the response of our prime minister seems to be catering to his demands about defending our border against organized crime by implementing a $1.3 billion border plan with enhanced coordination with our American partner to stop the flow of fentanyl. For this action, tariffs will be paused for 30 days if our prime minister decides to obey Donald Trump, then he will withhold the tariffs for 30 days. So, do you want to comment on this tactic, and how likely is this to be successful? And the approach of the prime minister himself, I think it's the wrong approach myself, but anyway.
It's hard to know how to respond because, we've seen that there are no shortages of descriptors to describe the president. You use the term autocratic. I would add egomaniacal, narcissistic, arrogant, patronizing, condescending. I think he is simply a toxic, privileged white man who happens to be sitting on the throne of possibly the most influential country in the world. And I think that that should quite frankly terrify everyone. And despite what we might think about Trump, he is the president of the United States. The U.S. is our largest trading partner and a relationship that we need to maintain. We can look for new markets, we can reduce our interprovincial barriers, but we can't quickly or easily shift away from trade with the United States. We signed our first trade agreement with the United States almost 40 years ago, January of 1988. NAFTA was signed in January of 92 and took effect in 1994. NAFTA was the first of the North American Free Trade Agreements. And we might remember, or some of your listeners might remember, that on the day that NAFTA trade agreement went into effect, the Zapatista army initiated an insurrection against the Mexican government in Chiapas. In hindsight, maybe we all should have taken a bit more of a militant approach to those trade agreements. But there were protests in all three countries against NAFTA. I was part of a student gathering in Guadalajara, Mexico, where we were trying to build solidarity among students from all three countries. But globalization and free trade agreements between countries are here to stay. There's nothing that at this point that we can do about. Canada currently has about 15 trade agreements that covers trade between 51 different countries. So we unfortunately can't simply dismiss his threats. There's roughly $900 billion worth of goods that moves between Canada and the United States. And there's no economic sense to what Trump is suggesting and what he hopes to accomplish by implementing these tariffs. Dan Lett, I think, accurately stated that this is a strategy based on hilariously erroneous theory, pumped full of deliberately erroneous numbers, that promises totally unachievable results. Trump is not a politician. Trump is a businessman who views everything and only sees things as transactional. Everything is a deal, and in every deal, he needs to be the winner and somebody else has to be a loser. I don't think he understands the concept of cooperation or collaboration or about people having shared interests or working for mutually beneficial results. For him, it's all about winners and losers. And should we be spending an additional $1.2 billion to make our border more secure? Absolutely not. The amount of illegal fentanyl entering the U.S. from Canada amounted to 0.2% of all the illegal fentanyl seized. And how much got through, we don't know. That 0.2% amounted to 14.6 kilograms of all the illegal fentanyl that entered the U.S. There was approximately 2,100 kilograms entered the U.S. through other entry points. It is reported that roughly 150 Americans are dying every day from fentanyl overdoses. But Canadians are dying as well. there were 4.9 kilograms of illegal fentanyl seized at the Canadian border coming in from the United States. Are we demanding that the U.S. up its border security? There is a global epidemic of opioid-related deaths. What good neighbors do is recognize their shared responsibility and work together to stop this illegal trade. We need to do more to help those who are addicted. Can you say safe injection sites? Now, this is an unbelievable tragedy on both sides of the border, but it is not Canada's fault, and we should certainly not be bullied into spending $1.2 billion on security to appease the deranged thinking of Donald Trump.
I think you've encapsulated everything about Donald Trump that needs to be said, and a madman, a totally madman. And there has to be laws in the United States Constitution that can deal with his behavior, because I believe all his behavior is illegal anyway, and I think that he could be challenged. And if there's a will to do it, hopefully there will be. But we can't continue in this manner. Yeah, and it has, as you pointed out, there's a serious drug problem in the United States. And the sources I have read claim that most of the drugs are from the Mexican border. And a significant amount of fentanyl originates from China. But, however, Trump does not want to penalize China very much. So he's more interested in persecuting other countries, Mexico and Canada. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure, I can talk about that a little bit. So in his initial talks about introducing tariffs, China was mentioned. Now, again, there's so much that comes out of that man's mouth every day that it's hard to know what to take seriously or how long he's even going to be on that particular thought. So in terms of the fentanyl, China is one of the largest manufacturers of fentanyl, as well as India. And I did a little bit of investigating to try to understand this, and hopefully I can clarify some of this for your listeners. So fentanyl is an opioid, and opioids are used for the treatment of pain. They are highly, highly addictive, and many of the manufacturers of the opioids knew this, and as we found out with the tobacco industry, they hid the research that pointed to the addiction problems. Purdue Pharma may be a name that some of your listeners recognize. It was one of the major producers of opioids, and it was successfully sued by families of people who died from opioid addiction. So look, people have accidents, athletes get hurt, workers are injured on the job. They seek relief and are prescribed an opioid to help deal with the pain. The pharmaceutical companies are well aware of the addictive nature of what they are prescribing, but they hand out scripts as fast as they can and are richly rewarded. Doctors are well aware of the addictive nature of what they are prescribing, but they are richly rewarded by the drug companies for their prescription patterns. There is an excellent, excellent Netflix series, and for those of your listeners, again, who haven't decided to cancel Netflix because it's U.S.-based, I would encourage you to watch it. It's called Painkiller, and it tells this horribly, horribly sad story of opioid addiction. Now, the addiction often, as many addictions do, take over people's lives, and they go to more and more extreme measures to feed their addiction, and this is where the illegal drug trade steps in, and this is when people die. It is estimated that roughly 150 Americans die every day from opioid addiction. That's 55,000 people a year, and that's tragic, and we need to do all we can to try to prevent those, as we do to prevent those similar deaths in Canada.
You're listening to CKOW 95.9 FM. Our guest this morning is Harold Schuster, and I'm here with John Dick. I know that where my daughter's across the street from where my daughter lives, there was a man that became addicted to opioids as a result of being given drugs in the hospital for a surgery or whatever. And, I'm not sure what happened, but that was one a case that I heard about in the neighborhood. In like manner, President Trump is courting the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he has announced his plan for Gaza. And the latest plan of the United States president is to develop the region of Gaza. What does that mean, and why would Prime Minister Netanyahu be pleased about that? As we know, he's got a plan. He's going to move people from Jordan. He's going to move all the Palestinians to Jordan, and then, you know, yeah. or Egypt, without consulting anybody.
Yeah, it's sometimes hard to see and understand. The whole dog and tail wagging scenario. Who is the dog in this, and who is the tail, and who's wagging who? But I'd like to step back for a second and try to put this into a context. Right? So the ceasefire in Gaza went into effect on January 19th of this year. Israel's genocidal onslaught against Gaza began 470 days prior to that on October 7th, 2023. Now, one of the claims made by Israel at that time and parroted by the entire Western world and repeated ad nauseum by mainstream press and politicians of every stripe, is that Hamas had violated a ceasefire and that Israel had the right to defend itself. It is preposterous to claim that Hamas has violated anything. They were exercising their internationally recognized right to defend themselves against an occupying army. There were clearly actions that were taken by some of the militants that violated international law, and that is why the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for certain Hamas leaders. So a ceasefire goes into effect. So in September of 2005, Israel withdrew its forces and abandoned about 25 illegal settlements that it had established in Gaza. Now, just prior to the withdrawal, and in the years since, there has been no less than 9 incursions by Israel into Gaza, including 4 wars. There's Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009, Pillar of Defense in 2012, Protective Edge in 2014, and the Unity Intifada in 2021. Now, these are against a people with no army, no military, no planes, tanks, and very limited and antiquated weapons of any kind. There has never been peace for the people of Gaza. They have been subjected to a reign of terror for 18 years, 18 years of an illegal blockade, 18 years left to languish in what has been described by many as the world's largest open-air prison. There was no ceasefire to break because Israel has never ceased its war on Gaza. Remember, Gaza is a tiny strip of land. It is 360 square kilometers. It's about 41 kilometers long and between 6 and 12 kilometers wide. Israel has one of the most sophisticated militaries on the face of the earth. It receives $38 billion a year as per an arrangement with Barack Obama back in 2016. And in the first year of its genocidal war, it received an additional $23 billion from President Biden. It has spent 470 days trying to erase Gaza from the face of the earth, no different than what it has been trying to do with the Palestinian people since 1948. The death toll is now well over 40,000, and we have no idea how many people might still be buried dead under the rubble. Most of those dead were women and children and the elderly, and Israel has engaged in multiple war crimes, which has resulted in the International Criminal Court, similar to what it's done with leaders of Hamas, charging Prime Minister Netanyahu and his former Minister of Defense, Gallant, with war crimes. Israel stated that it had 2 war aims at the beginning of this genocidal frenzy. The first was to bring the Israeli hostages captured on October 7th back by military means. But the absolute overall key aim that was articulated over and over again in public was to completely eliminate Hamas. And it has failed on both counts. The ceasefire has the potential to satisfy the first Israeli goal in releasing the hostages, but the second goal will never be accomplished because you cannot destroy the steadfastness of the Palestinian people. Because for the citizens of Gaza, the goal is not a ceasefire, but the end of the occupation, the end of apartheid, and justice for the Palestinian people. Now, if the ceasefire holds, and that is far from certain long-term, short-term perhaps, but after the 42 days of phase one, there's no guarantee anything will last. The phase one involves the release of all remaining Hamas-held hostages, as well as those held in illegal detention by Israel. The movement of citizens back to the north of Gaza is also part of this first phase, and the complete withdrawal of Israel from Gaza. Phase two would have Israel maintaining some presence near the Philadelphia corridor, which is the strip of land between Gaza and Egypt. And phase three is negotiations for a permanent ceasefire. We all know how well previous negotiations have gone to try to bring peace and justice to that. I don't think anybody is under any illusions that these negotiations will result in anything different. But there's been no consensus on who will govern Gaza after Israel withdraws. There's no talk about the status of the UN Relief and Work Agencies, UNRWA, which has been outlawed by Israel, but is really the only body that has the ability to provide the vast quantities of humanitarian aid needed by Gazans. And Israel has already stated very clearly that it maintains its right to re-engage militarily. And I am sure it has already planned on how to do that and is inventing multiple excuses for how it can blame Hamas for violating the agreement.
Yes, that you've given a very bleak picture of the whole situation. And of course, the reason why Israel is so confident is that they're bolstered by the United States. That is the tragedy for sure. I would just hope and pray that people start waking up throughout the world about what is really going on. I do believe that there's a shift in the tide is turning, that people are starting to see the Palestinians in a different light. I think that has a lot to do with the protests that have been going on throughout the city and the educational attempts that have been made, and your own advocacy for peace and justice and fairness. You have done a lot of work, Harold, in exposing the fraudulence of the.
Thank you. I think just quickly on that, there has been, I think, a significant change in attitudes, and it's not that. You know, people are starting to see and hear the story of the Palestinian, and they are beginning to understand what has happened in occupied Palestine since 1948 from the Palestinian perspective. As I've, you know, said on your show in the past, is that most of what we in the West have come to understand, or how we have come to see the occupation, is from the Israeli and the Zionist perspective. And that is, you know, that is one side. And it is, as I've said and many said, a very inaccurate picture of what has been going on. And now that people are starting to understand and see the Palestinians as a people who have every right that every other person should have, and not simply being framed as terrorists who only want to see the elimination of Israel and wiping it off the map. This is not what they are saying. This is not what they mean when they say, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. This is not about eradicating or wiping Jews or Israel off the map. This is about ensuring that everybody who lives on that piece of land between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River has the same rights and is treated with dignity and equality and fairness.
Yeah, and a commentary from the Palestinians about being sent to Jordan was I heard this on the news that the Palestinians said, "We love our land. We love Gaza. No matter if it's in rubbles, we love our land." And that was such a strong, such a powerful statement to make. And what we are seeing now, horribly, is a new world order being dominated by oligarchs coming up. I mean, what's happening in the United States? These are all the rich people that are in the Senate, and there's Elon Musk who is involved, and they have, the oligarchs have no respect for human rights, and so we are being bullied by these people who have no sense of justice and are above the law, and. Maybe you might want to comment on that, and also on Elon Musk, who has, for some reason, he has very special privileges, and he has the right to look into documents that nobody has ever seen before, and he's cutting off all pensions to elderly people. That's one of the things he did. And interestingly, my friend Laura, who lives in Chilliwack. She lived in the United States for 2 years, years ago, that she worked there. And she has been receiving a small pension every month from the United States. Well, she's been cut off, as are all the seniors or people in the United States have been cut off from their pensions by Elon Musk, of all people, who has access to all personal information. And do you want to comment on that situation of the oligarchy forming it?
I just want to step back for a second to talk about this this idea of creating a Riviera of the Middle East, right? And how Palestinians and Jordan and Egypt both have responded to that. So, you know, this idea of creating a Riviera of the Middle East is just another crazy idea dreamed up by Trump. There has been no consultation with anyone, certainly no discussion with the Palestinian people. And as you said, you know, they love their land, and it's their land. It is up to them to decide what happens to it. It's the incredible arrogance somehow of Trump to think that it is his, or that the U.S. can take it over, like he mused about Greenland or the Panama Canal or even Canada. And this patronizing attitude that somehow his vision of a Riviera in the Middle East is something that would make the Palestinians happy. Happy to do what? How would they be able to go back, you know, and what would they come back to? Would they be, what, chambermaids and dishwashers in luxury hotels? And the governments of both Egypt and Syria have stated in no uncertain terms that they will not take in any Gazans. Saudi Arabia has stated clearly that it will not agree to any normalization process with Israel without a guarantee of a Palestinian state. And Palestinians themselves have made it absolutely clear that Gaza is theirs, and they and only they will decide what it looks like going forward. Civil society groups inside occupied Palestine, as well as representatives in the diaspora, have voiced their very strong opposition to Trump's delusional dream. I watched a very good interview with Mustafa Barghouti. He's a physician and the head of the general counsel of the Palestinian National Initiative. And there are active attempts to unite the various Palestinian factions to put forward a consensus plan for what a Palestinian state will look like. We unfortunately don't hear much about that, and that's to the to the way that Israel and Palestine continues to be talked about and referred to in the mainstream press. About what is happening now with Musk and the executive orders that are being passed by Trump, like minute by minute almost, it's about oligarchs, but it's also, we are seeing an alarming rise of fascism. You know, Viktor Orban in Hungary and Hungary seems to be the go-to place for authoritarian training. Our former prime minister, the great defender and friend of Israel, Stephen Harper, now heads up something called the International Democracy Union. And that is an organization that helps hard right-wing leaders get elected. He has spent an awful lot of time in Hungary working with and visiting with Viktor Orban. And we're not just seeing it in the musings of people like Trump, but in the mainstreaming of fascist language and the actions of the administrators and political actors who are implementing Trump's executive orders. There is a complete shuttering of U.S. aid, which will directly lead to thousands of unnecessary deaths due to the lack of care and medicine. Hundreds of federal employees are being given buyout options or facing firing, many of them not even sure they will get paid in these buyouts, and deportations. People are being put on military planes in handcuffs and shackled and sent back to their countries of origin. There was, maybe one bright light in that, the president of Colombia refused to allow an American military plane carrying supposedly illegal Colombians back to Colombia, and the president refused to let the plane land because the Colombian citizens who were on that plane were in handcuffs and shackled and being treated like prisoners. And the president of Colombia told Trump that, you know, you cannot treat people like that, and he refused to let the plane land. So I say, good on Colombia. For
the same thing happened to Mexico, where the Mexicans are going to be shipped over to Mexico, back to Mexico, and Mexico refused to take them. And I don't know where they're going. Maybe Guantanamo Bay. I think that was, well, this is horrible. Yeah. This is terrible.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And now I'll get a little bit. Now you asked about what Elon Musk is doing as the head of DOGE, right, which is the Department of Government Efficiency, I think. So what he is doing to the American economy through his appointment to DOGE is absolutely criminal. And there are numerous lawsuits being filed over numerous actions that he is undertaking. See, the American people are trying to fight back. But Musk is you know, the bull in the China shop on steroids. There is so much about there's so much about the individuals who see and understand running a government, you know, a democracy, you know, however flawed our understanding of that term, in a global world where there is at least a minimal amount of concern shown for those who are in crisis, mostly the result of, you know, Western settler colonialism. But Musk and Trump see government as a business, and everything they don't immediately see as making money is deemed inefficient and axed. And as I say, Americans are fighting back. But I think for me, one of the biggest concerns I have with Musk, which seems to be getting little concern, was for his very public Nazi salutes.
Mm-hmm.
He stood up on a stage in front of the world during Trump's inauguration and gave not just one, but two Nazi salutes. And I think the absolute worst response came from the U.S.-based Anti-Defamation League. This is a Jewish human rights group and a self-described warrior against anti-Semitism. Their dismissals of those Sieg Heils as simply an awkward gesture and then calling for calm can only be understood in terms of their support for Israel and Zionism. Again, as I've stated here before, the only thing more abhorrent to Jewish legacy institutions than anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism. And that is the only way to understand the response from the ADL and for the complete silence by the official, and those in quotes, Jewish community here in Canada, the B'nai B'rith, Sija, and the Jewish federations. Just think for a moment, if that supposedly awkward gesture was made by a brown-skinned, keffiyeh-wearing person, would there be any doubt in anybody's mind what that was? The screams and wails coming from the Zionists would be deafening.
Yeah, that's a very good comment. Do you have any comments, John?
Yeah, I'm just more curious, like, with the Elon's gesture, like, what did he have to gain from that even? Like, it seems like doing something like that, that's only going to have a bad response. So I'm just wondering, like, what he was even thinking. Like, is he an actual, you know, does he agree with that ideology and that's what he's trying to communicate? And if so, why would he want people to know that he agrees with that ideology when it's going to hurt his brand, like, a lot?
Mm-hmm. I think he knew exactly what he was doing, right? And I think he did it because, as we've seen, he was able to get away with it. You know, he has spent quite a bit of time in Germany with a very far-right neo-Nazi political party in Germany, who, you know, he is telling to, you know, stop, you know, being ashamed of Germany's past, about stop, you know, about stopping, you know, to be concerned, and about regaining power. Right? So he did that, I think, very deliberately. And I think, again, I think he did it knowing exactly what he was doing. And that is, I think, speaking to the, you know, the insurgents from January 6th who took over the White House, those, you know, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, who were among the first of the people that Trump exonerated and released from prison. I mean, those were neo-Nazis. Those are people who believe absolutely in a you know, a white Christian society, and how the United States is being overtaken by non-Christians or non-white people. And I think Musk's you know, salute was to them, right? To, you know, we are now in charge, and this is an attitude. These are our behaviors and actions that are not going to be prosecuted. And I think we should all be very, very afraid. But I mean, this was not, you know, done, I don't think, in the spur of the moment, or without a pretty good understanding of what it was going to mean, and was sending a very clear and very scary message.
Yeah, rather subliminal messages are being being sent. As we're getting close to the end of our time, Harold, I wanted to comment on Maude Barlow from the Council of Canadians. She has spoken about human rights, on human rights, universality, and environmental rights. And she says that the rights, the integrity of our economy with a superpower through a deal being promoted by American corporations eager for our resources is something that we need to be concerned about and to regret. She says we must protect our waters from Donald Trump's manifest destiny ambitions. And then consumer advocate Ralph Nader has also commented strongly against Trumpism. And we are at the point of history, he says, when the people have to matter and the people have to resist. So do you want to just comment on these two commentaries from Maude Barlow and Ralph Nader?
Sure, yeah. I've known Maude for a long time. I, you know, first sort of met her and, you know, started following some of her work back at the time of the free trade agreements, both the first and the second, the free trade agreement with the U.S. And the NAFTA between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. And I have a great deal of respect for her tireless work fighting against these trade agreements and the damages that they have done to workers and the environment. But what I think needs to happen is that I think we need to really re-examine our relationship and the language we use to our natural resources. I think we need to adopt a position of where we are stewards of the land, and that our natural resources, which includes water, are not seen simply as a resource that can be bought and sold. Right? We need to re-examine and come to a much deeper understanding of the life force that water is. You know, I was at a very good conference a couple of weekends ago. It was about Muslim indigenous solidarity. And part of what was discussed was the origin stories or the creation stories that both indigenous people tell and Muslims tell. And then I sort of compared that to sort of the Judeo-Christian creation story. And for indigenous people in particular, they see their relationship with the earth, with water, you know, all of these life-giving forces as a duty and responsibility to care for them. You know, the Judeo-Christian creation story talks about God giving man domain over, you know, the land and the animals and resources. Yeah. And that's been interpreted as having ownership and the ability to use them, to exploit them for whatever purposes we may have. And most of that is for corporate profits. And if we reexamine that and really begin to understand that the resources, the air, the land, the water, are what sustain us and what keeps us alive, I think we would hope that we would start changing our attitude towards it. You know, we get a little quick little story about, you know, simply about water, right? I think it's still outrageous that, you know, when people are brushing their teeth, the tap is running. I work out at the gym, you know, 2-3 times a week. I think there are 10 shower stalls. And every time, every single time I am at the gym, at least half of them are dripping, right? And so I, you know, I go around and I turn off all those taps. I mean, it's, you know, it's simply because people don't really care. People don't think beyond their own needs, you know. And I think if we switched our attitude, if we started to really, you know, recognize and concern ourselves with what our future on this planet is going to be, we need to take way better care of our resources. You know, again, the you know, the origin or the creation story of the indigenous people about, you know, being on you know, Turtle Island. They are in the back of a turtle in the water, and they recognize that, you know, their relationship to the land and water is tied very much to the animals, to everything around them, and so yeah. They care for them.
Everything is connected. Every creature is connected. That's true. Yeah. Well, we're running out of time, Harold, and I really appreciate all that you've said, and it's been wonderful talking to you again. And
thank you.
Yeah. So I think we are going to be having a musical break and have to change our topic a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Up From Here by Logan Richard.
He's from Prince Edward Island, I understand.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So I'll say goodbye. Thank you again, both to you, Mary Jane, and
we can only go up from here. Don't look now, what's in the rear view mirror? Don't look back, don't reprise. Don't let your dust get in your eyes. I know we can only go up from here. Nobody told you, nobody tried. They could have warned you about the devil on your mama's side. You bit the apple from the family tree, and now you're a shadow of the person that you used to be. We can only go let your dust get in your eyes. I know we can only go up from here. Sooner or later, it was bound to be. Was it the way you played your hand, or was it destiny? Does it matter? I'm here with you now, and I'll hold your hand through all the darkness till your sun comes out.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. This is Wooden Spoons with Mary Jane Eason and John Dick.
Do you have the time and temperature?
Time is 8:48 a.m. and the temperature is minus 16.
Okay. Yeah, we're sort of running out of time. I had plans to talk about fighting diabetes and things like that, but that's okay. I wanted to mention that Fun Drive is coming up next week. That's February the 14th on Valentine's Day, and we hope that you join us. This is a community radio, and the community is, we are inviting the community to join us in supporting the station every year at this time of year to raise money for the station so that we can continue to have the programs that are being offered, amazing number of different diverse programs on CKUW. If you look through the Stylist magazine, there's all kinds of programs of every nature, musical kind, talk shows, music shows, and so on. So that's starting next week. We look forward to hearing from you next week. We're going to be asking for pledges to donate to the station, to as we do every year, for 2 weeks. Also, wanted to mention that at Mary Jane's Cooking School, this is our second Saturday of the month, and we are offering a second Saturday soups, as we call it. So we have soups for sale on Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m. The soups are going to be butternut squash soup and also minestrone, two different types of soups that we offer. And if you're interested, you can call Mary Jane's Cooking School, 204-775-2522. And you can pick up the soup on Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m. And we're located at 252 Arlington Street. So we hope to see you. We hope to hear from you. And I will provide a bit of information on from the book I guess it's called Defeating Diabetes. It's written by Brenda Davis. She's a registered dietitian, and Tom Bernard, who's a medical doctor. And she writes, in our fast-paced world, stress becomes a fact of life. We have a hurried lifestyle. We are having to keep up with all the demands. So maybe there's... Merle Friedman was a doctor. He was the first practitioner to identify type A personality, which is the intense, somewhat aggressive individuals who see the world as a hostile place. And apparently Dr. Friedman's, his upholsterer. That was somebody that was repairing the seats, the chairs in his office that had upholstery on them. He was the first person to note that there was an unusual pattern of wear and tear on the upholstery of the chairs in Dr. Friedman's waiting room, and this. And this Dr. Friedman had noted that the patients wore out the arms and fronts of the chairs in which they sat. Dr. Friedman eventually linked this this trait of personality which he termed type A, or a driver's personality, to those who were at special risk for the development of heart disease. He also noted hostility and seeing everyone as a competitor, and anger was also present in those who had a tendency to develop heart disease. So that was kind of an interesting discovery that came about because of an upholsterer who noticed this thing that was happening with the chairs. So because heart disease is a big concern for people with diabetes, monitoring stress can be as important as monitoring blood sugar. So he's recommending that we have to practice techniques to calm the mind. You can do yoga, different types of prana yoga. There's a lot of different breathing exercise techniques that energize the body and brings a sense of serenity and well-being. There's also meditation and there's prayer. Those things are very calming for the mind. So having a psychological reserve of calmness can affect the level of stress that surround us. And one of the things that I was really impressed was that caring for others and showing kindness and friendship has a very good effect on the heart. When we are in a competitive mindset, there are elevations in blood sugar. The adrenal gland pours out adrenaline and cortisol, which over time predisposes us to insulin resistance. And these hormones, of course, are needed when we do need a burst of energy when we are under a threat. But we can't have this type of energy in our bodies all the time. So he was making a point of actually try to be calm. And one way of keeping calm and peaceful is to be kind. And it's I thought this was... He said kindness is a central piece for reducing stress. So they gave an example of us. You're standing in line in the bank. It's a long line. It's taking a long time. And somebody is behind you, twitching around and being agitated. And what the person could do would be, in a friendly way, ask the person if they would like to take her space to reduce the weight, like just little things like that. So kindness is something we need to cultivate. Kindness and friendship, it's good for your heart. And I mean, you're not doing it for that reason, but kindness has its own value. And it makes life a lot easier for everyone. I have a bit of a short recipe today. It is called caraway cabbage salad. And I thought it was a simple recipe, and I have time to share it right now as we end our program. It calls for 1 tablespoon of cider vinegar and 1 teaspoon of caraway seeds, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1/8 teaspoon of garlic salt, and 1 teaspoon of prepared mustard, and 1 cup of plain yogurt. That is the dressing. And then the salad itself calls for 2 medium red apples, unpeeled and chopped coarsely. Now, maybe you might want to peel it, because I think apples have a coating of wax on them these days. So take these 2 apples, you chop them coarsely, 1 teaspoon of lemon juice, 2 cups of shredded green cabbage, and 2 cups of shredded red cabbage, 3/4 cups of finely chopped celery. So you combine the vinegar and spices, fold in the yogurt, cover and chill for several hours. To prepare the salad, coat the apples with lemon juice, and that prevents them from browning. And when ready to serve, mix the dressing with the apples and cabbage and celery. So this is a very simple recipe for a cabbage caraway salad with a yogurt-based dressing. Now we have come to our end of our program this morning. Thank you for listening. And
you've been listening to Wooden Spoon, sponsored by Mary Jane's Cooking School on CKUW 95.9 FM. For our podcast, please go to ckuw.ca, type Wooden Spoons in the search bar, and the show will be up in just a few hours. Till next time, this is John Dick and Mary Jane Eason saying bye for now, and thanks for listening.